next.
Okay.
Mics are on, guys.
Okay.
All right. Break this table.
That's too bad.
Good afternoon. The Senate Finance Judiciary Division is in order. It's April 4th, 2013. We will finish our agenda today. It's our hope that we can accomplish this by 2:30. We will go until 3 o'clock if necessary, and we have the room scheduled for 6 if we need to, but I'm not expecting that we'll need to do that. Senator Thompson, Senate File 873, you're first up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, pardon me.
Senator Thompson, this bill came through the Policy Committee. I understand that you have an amendment you'd like to address, and then we can have staff go through the fiscal impact.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, I, in fact, do have the A2 amendment, if staff could get that to the members. And
Senator, before you go on, I'm going to note, number one, that amendment is in the members' packets, and number two, we do have a quorum present.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
All right, Mr. Chairman and members, what this amendment does very simply is it deletes Section 2, which starts on line 2.18 on page 2. And this was a provision that really was added in hopes that all the parties would appreciate it, allowing individuals to come and reclaim impounded vehicles. And if it was a DWI situation, they would have to put the device on the car to track blood alcohol levels in order to start the vehicle. And we kind of thought it was one of those things that everybody would be interested in preserving, but in fact they're not, and it's not essential to the bill. And in fact, the House version of this bill has passed without it, so it is not a provision I'm prepared to work to die in the hill for. And so if somebody wants to move the amendment, if there's no discussion, otherwise I'd be happy to take questions.
Senator Thompson, I'll just note my disappointment that it's not moving forward with that amendment, because you know I've been a strong advocate of ignition interlock program, and it really does advance the public safety, which is why it's been successful and supported across the political spectrum. I mean, there already is a provision in statute for vehicles subject to forfeiture to be returned to the owner, but I think it's only subject to a disabling device, which... I guess it allows the vehicle to waste away in the owner's possession instead of in the impound lot, but I'm not sure exactly what it accomplishes. I think there's some other areas of the law where forfeited property can be returned to the owner subject to the posting of a bond, but that's not the case with DWI vehicles because of the unique nature, the relation of the offense to the vehicle itself. But I understand there's a fiscal aspect to the ignition interlock component as well as some policy decisions. You're the chief author, and I will certainly respect your desires to how you think you can move the bill forward.
Appreciate it. Mr. Chairman, if I may just respond to your request, just to be clear that this will in no way subject the public to any safety concerns. Actually, as the law is currently written, the individual does not have the option to even reclaim this car. So what this has done is this would have allowed the individual to get the vehicle back with the device put on it. I don't want to open up a can of worms here. There's some concern at the department, the DPS, Department of Public Safety, and so I'm with you, Senator Latz. So, Mr. Chairman, I would have preferred to leave it in there, but DPS has some concerns. So I would, again, respectfully ask that someone move the amendment if you believe it's appropriate, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any discussion? Senator Goodwin, you willing to move the amendment?
I will.
Yes, sir.
Senator Goodwin moves adoption of the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson. Anything further before we have fiscal staff review the bill?
Nothing from me, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, members, there is a completed fiscal note for Senate File 873 in your packet. And in it, the court state that there could possibly be an increase in challenges to forfeiture on the bill. It's impossible to quantify. So the courts say there is no fiscal impact to them. However, right before the hearing, DPS came up and told us that they have a possible cost that remains in the bill even after the amendment. And what I'm going to do, what I recommend is that we pass this bill to full finance, and I'll request a new fiscal note on the second engrossment, and then we'll have that discussion in full finance.
Is that an acceptable process for you, Senator Thompson?
It is, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
All right. Is there any further discussion on Senate File 873? Not seeing any. Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 873. For these, do we say they're recommended to pass?
Or
is that the appropriate language, then?
Full finance.
Be recommended to pass and be sent up to full finance committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Thompson, that takes care of Senate File 873. Next on the agenda, Senate File 874, also Senator Thompson. Do you have anything else to add in connection with this bill? This is the other piece of the forfeiture-related matters. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman, and I have nothing to add. I'd be interested in hearing from Mr. Turner, and that's the only aspect of this bill that I came here to discuss.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, members. Senate File 874 has a completed note in the packet. The note states that the court doesn't believe the bill would have any impact on the number of forfeiture cases filed or the overall time the court spends on forfeiture cases, and states in essence that there's no fiscal impact to this bill.
All right. I've received a note that Don Ryan from the County Attorneys Association would like to speak on this bill. Please note we are dealing with the budgetary impacts today, not the policies related to the bill. But please come on forward, Mr. County Attorney, if you'd like to be heard.
Fill that out.
I fill that out first, or
doesn't
matter. Mr. Ryan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator. I would let the committee know I've never done this before, so if I get out of line, just kind of work me through the process, will you?
Treat it like a court of law. I'm sure you're experienced in that regard.
Well, you probably don't want my average one-hour closing argument, though, I'm thinking.
That's true.
My name is Don Ryan. I'm the Crow Wing County Attorney, elected 1994. I've served in that capacity since then, and I am this year blessed enough to serve as the president of the County Attorney's Association, so I'm here in both capacities. I do have a handout for the committee, a letter from the city attorney from the city of Minneapolis. If I mention that, someone will pick it up and distribute it. So
that's true. And it'll be distributed and we'll make it a part of the record.
I'm sorry, sir.
No problem.
I had come intending to speak on 873 and 874 together, as in my view they are, you know, I understand they're separate bills before the Senate, but they are intertwined in regards to how I, a practitioner in the field, are going to be acting with that. I'm assuming that would be okay.
Go ahead. You can address them both.
And I understand this is a fiscal hearing, not a policy hearing, but I probably will make a couple of policy-type statements tying them into the fiscal impact. If I go too far, please let me know, Senator. I just have a couple of points. I don't intend to go through the bill line by line. I know you've all done that already, but there are a couple of different points I wish to make. Begin with the concept of prima facie evidence. Basically, prima facie evidence is evidence that's presented, and it stands on its own, but it's typically rebuttable. And it's when it's standing there on its own, as the proponent provides it, the opponent gets to try to rebut that. As I read the bill currently before, it would be 873, there is no opportunity for the state to rebut the prima facie showing, so which means it would just stand, which would be a significant shift in jurisprudence in the state of Minnesota, to my understanding. And also, even if you look at the federal level, I know there are references to, I'll get to it in a minute, willfully ignorant being synonymous with the federal standard of willfully, forget the term, I'm sorry, but even at the federal level, it's a rebuttable situation. In any event, if I look at the opportunity for someone to present prima facie evidence, and actually the language in the bill makes it look like it's a very small burden. In other words, what would prima facie evidence be? Can the person come forward and say, I have an interest in the bill, I have an interest in that car, do they need to provide some kind of documentation? It's silent, so I believe that's going to create litigation in regards to the what is actually prima facie evidence. And if we're not allowed to provide rebuttal evidence to try to overcome an initial prima facie showing, the state's going to have to litigate what is and isn't prima facie evidence then in this setting, which is going to create piecemeal litigation through the courts for years to come in an attempt to define what that would be, which will have a fiscal impact on everybody. Also, with the burden being as low as it appears, it will in all probability result in multiple people being able to come forward and establish prima facie that they have some kind of interest in the particular assets that are subject to the forfeiture. And they won't be the defendants. They won't be the people who are necessarily even the family members. It might be someone saying, hey, Bill needed to raise some money for bail, so he told me he would sell me the two firearms or whatever it would be, and so I gave him $1,000 and it's posted. Well, when I get to the willful negligent or the willfully ignorant standard, does that mean that he has to ask, well, wait a minute, were those guns involved in the crime? Well, that's never going to happen, but if it has to be an intentional non-conduct to be willfully ignorant, then that means this person is going to have made a prima facie showing that they have an interest in the guns. And then someone else comes and says, well, wait a minute, he gave me those guns 2 years ago because we were hunting. I said I really like that shotgun, and so really that's mine. Now I have two people who made a prima facie showing, which we can't rebut. How are we going to sort that out? It's going to take judicial action. And frankly, I think what I would do, or I would have my people doing, if that case happens in Crow Wing County, is I'll bring an interpleader action. And I'll say, look, court, judge, I don't know who owns this gun or these guns. I don't know who does or doesn't have an interest. So here, they're yours. I'm going to give them to you. Dismiss me out of this action, and you decide. You let all these people come into court and argue, and you decide who does or doesn't have an interest in the gun and who is the rightful owner of the gun and who has the right for possession, because now I'm dismissing, in essence, my forfeiture thing, where I have two people who have now made a legal showing sufficient to suffice with this language. I don't know who to give it to. And I'm not going to get sued by either one of them by giving it to the wrong person, so, judge, I want you to make that decision for me, and I'm gone. I submit that will happen quite frequently, and I think on a statewide basis, and it'll have a significant fiscal impact on the courts.
County Attorney, what would the problem be if, in fact, either of those persons had legitimate ownership rights in the property?
If, in fact, it wasn't an instrumentality of the crime, and whatever the asset would be, and it is a true innocent owner situation, we probably would give it back today as it is. I can tell you that in the calendar year 2011, of all of the forfeitures we did in our office, and there were 106, 27.37% of those cases went back to innocent owners or to lien holders who could come in and show us under the current standard that they were an innocent owner or had an interest in it. So, for instance, if a bank has a lien on a car, and we'll give it back to them. All they have to do is promise to us by signing a piece of paper they won't give it back to the person who just got done driving drunk with the car. In 2012, we had 18.11%, which were given back to innocent owners. I'm sorry, Senator.
What percentage of those given back to innocent owners were, in fact, automobiles that were given to the lien holder?
Overall, in regards to the lien holder, it was 4.72% and 22.65% that actually went back to the owner in 2011. And in 2012, it was 17.15% that went to the owner and 0.96% that went to the lien holder.
0.96%?
0.96 to the lien holder in 2012. So I can only give you we don't really track those types of stats sure. All that closely. And I've talked with prosecutors across the state on this. Everyone, I can speak for Crow Wing County. Every prosecutor I know exercises that same kind of discretion, whether it be Dakota, whether it be Hennepin, whether it be Wantowan, Crow Wing, and I can go through, I'm not going to name all 87 counties, but every county attorney's office I know exercises that same discretion today. in regards to getting things back to innocent owners. If there's not another question, I'm going to move on to the concept of affirmative defense.
Yeah, please, and tie it into the budget impact, please.
I will.
We've had long hearings already on the policy of this.
No, and again, on the affirmative defense, in Minnesota and at the federal level, it's the proponent of an affirmative defense that has the burden of proof, at least initially. I'll use self-defense as an example. Granted, it's criminal court, but it's an easy example. If I'm prosecuting someone for murder and they want to claim self-defense, they have the initial burden of establishing to the court's satisfaction that self-defense is appropriate to be used. The burden then shifts to me as the prosecutor to prove that it doesn't apply in this case. And that's true in civil court as well. I happen to do more criminal work, so I'm more comfortable making those examples. If now it becomes the state's job as the opponent of an affirmative defense to try to predetermine what affirmative defenses do or do not apply, and then disprove them, almost having to disprove the double negative up front before maybe it's even raised, that again is going to create litigation, hence it's the fiscal note. The fiscal policy, it's going to cost us money and resources. We'll have no choice but to attempt to do that, and we're more than likely going to have to litigate more cases in the forfeiture arena than we do today. And again, the policy then will be made on a piecemeal litigation case-by-case basis, like so many other types of judicial policies or standards that are created. One of the things these bills attempt to do is adopt the term willfully blind. So in other words, as I understand it, willfully ignorant is supposed to be the equivalent of the willfully blind federal standard. Now, it is defined in Section 5 of Bill 874, and then it's also provided for in Section 15 of Bill 873. But basically, that's the concept as I get the blending of the two of them. Well, at the federal level, willfully blind is an affirmative defense. And the burden is the burden of the person or the opponent to, once the federal government establishes that the asset is subject to forfeiture, was involved in the offense or whatever, then the affirmative defense shifts over to the proponent of it to show whatever that standard is, I think it's a preponderance of the evidence, that it in fact applies. If they can meet that burden, the burden shifts back then to the state or the federal government in that instance to overcome, again by preponderance of the evidence, to show that it was used with the person's knowledge, consent, or because of the person's willful blindness. So by shifting the burden of proof in an affirmative defense, once again, it's going to change Minnesota jurisprudence as it has existed for as long as I've been an attorney, and it's going to create litigation. We're going to have to litigate those, and we will litigate them in Crow Wing County, because we're going to have to sort out what is willful blindness or willful ignorance. When does that shift or not shift? And since we can't overcome the prima facie showing that someone does or doesn't have an interest, that's probably where the majority of the litigation is going to go. And one of my real serious concerns is that this could potentially create a backlog similar to the source code when you were looking at that stuff. And I know the legislature and the courts, we've dealt with that for a long time, because as we're sorting through some of these things, judges across the state aren't probably going to want to make inconsistent decisions, and so ultimately there'll be enough cases there, and we might have to go up the same way. So we might be sitting here 10 years from now not having this particular concept ironed out yet, with all the backlogs, and whether it be an instant fiscal impact on the courts, prosecutors, defense lawyers, in the system, or whether it's going to be a deferred one 10 years down the line and just let it keep building up and building up. It's going to be real, and my fear is that it's really going to happen.
Well, Mr. Ryan, the source code was a piece of litigation in which the thousands of cases that were involved had essentially the identical scientific question that was being addressed as to whether or not the computer code that ran the intoxilizer instrument had some problems with it, and that was easily combined in front of Judge Abrams down in Scott County, now Dakota County, I think is where he's chambered, to handle that litigation. This other stuff, it sounds like the kind of legal questions, not scientific questions, that would be much more appropriate for the rather regular litigation and appellate process. And every time we change a law around here, we get a word change, and it's subject to appellate analysis if that's deemed appropriate by either the parties of the litigation.
I agree with that, Senator Lotz, and I know attorneys have to eat too, and as a former public defender, you know, those are the areas that we worked in, and as a prosecutor now, we still try to anticipate and work in those areas. And that's why I said similar to, because there are significant differences. I just know that that is a recent one that would be fresh in the committee's mind, so I just wanted to try to draw, I'll maybe be a very poor reference or association with a different case, to show the magnitude with which I believe this particular legislation could create issues within the courts. And so that was my intent.
All right. Did you have anything else to add with regard to the budgetary impact?
I also believe in looking at the innocent owner aspects of it on the post-defense stuff, I think that again, will be sorted out through the courts. What will be significant, what is enough notice, if you will, or when is a person going to be willfully ignorant? Do they need, if we flag the title before it's sold and we flag it, but they haven't checked with DOT, if we file a notice of less pendants, if it's a piece of property, I mean, allowing a framework where people can dispense of the potentially forfeitable assets post-situation, again, I believe will lead to additional litigation. And in looking at 874, because I know you'd like me to wrap it up, I think that there are several questions in regards to what will constitute a Rule 14 admission of guilt. Are 15218 stay of adjudications going to work? Diversion contracts where you have admissions of guilt, but maybe there's not an actual stay of adjudication. Alford pleas where there really isn't an admission of guilt, but you do get the conviction. I mean, are those going to be covered? What if you're in a trial situation and the person actually confesses and testifies in court that, yes, I did this, but for whatever reason, for a technicality, the case is dismissed? Do we have to give the guns and the bulletproof vests back, even though they've admitted to using them in an armed robbery, for instance, which is also contained within the two bills? I also believe that, you know, as a former defense lawyer and dealing with defense lawyers currently, they typically like to look at global resolutions in these cases, and it's not unusual in the drug arena to have more than one count or more than one charge pending at the same time with the same defendant with different assets associated with both. If we go through the Rule 14 process and we get an admission on the record and say case A, but we're going to dismiss case B and C, will that be sufficient, or do we have to take and get a conviction in each case, in which case there will be more criminal trials? So the fiscal impact might be more neutral in the forfeiture side, but on the criminal side, I think you're going to see more trials. I just, from our perspective, again, looking just at the fiscal aspect of it, it doesn't seem that going to something along the lines of willful blindness is really what it is. I mean, to say that the person or the defendant has to take deliberate actions to avoid confirming a high probability of wrongdoing and who can almost be said to have actually known of the critical facts is an impossible burden, and it's going to create litigation. And that is that's the federal standard in the federal case law, because it's not codified. It's judicial creation at the federal level, this willful blindness. And it's going to create a backlog within the courts, in my particular opinion. And right now, if I take a snapshot of yesterday, I have 49.31% of our forfeiture cases are in some type of a judicial hearing right now, whether it be in conciliation court, whether it be pending a pretrial, pending a court trial, whether it be pending, it's currently under advisement with the court. 49.31%. And so I believe that it will be almost malpractice under these new standards for a defense lawyer not to take these to trial anymore, because if the burden completely shifts to the prosecution to show, then they have to go and they have to take that risk and they have to try to represent their client to the best they could. As a former public defender and private sector defense lawyer, I would have done that, and I would expect nothing less from my brothers and sisters on the other side of the aisle, so to speak, in the criminal justice system, who are in the trenches every day doing the best they can for their clients. So I'll go from 49 to 100%. Thank you.
This will be a separate question whether or not the public defense defenders are willing to take on civil forfeiture actions. Right now, I don't think they take any of that on.
I probably misspoke with that. I'm sorry, Senator. I didn't mean to bring the public defense or the public defense system into it.
You might have the private defense bar holding the state to its burden of proof more frequently,
and
but that's part of the point of the legislation, as I understand it.
No, I get that, but I guess the point is, if nearly 50% are already in a judicial proceeding, is that, I mean, we can debate the numbers, and perhaps, some discussion should happen, and I know that from the association's perspective and from my perspective personally. I'd be happy to engage in that conversation. We could do it over the summer or whenever. We just don't believe that this creates the framework that is going to get to where I believe the intent is to go. And we're unable to really determine exactly what system we're trying to incorporate, because it looks like we've different aspects of different systems have been cherry-picked and kind of put together. And I don't mean to be negative when I say that. That just is the impression from the simple country lawyer's limited ability to communicate. So thank you.
Well, Mr. County Attorney, with regard to the conviction requirements, that's already the law in almost every criminal offense with regard to property that's involved in the crime. So Senate File 874 merely essentially adds controlled substance offenses to the categories where conviction is required. So I don't know that you'd have the level of litigation that you're forecasting. Seems to me there's probably already some case law out there some of these questions, because it's been the law in most other criminal offenses all along.
In many of those situations, there are obviously in the drug forfeiture arena, there have been a larger extent or more of an ability to do the administrative type of forfeitures, particularly if they weren't contested. And if the convictions, I mean, in civil court, the standards are different than they are in the criminal court. And so if we need to acquire convictions in every one of these situations, which is beyond the reasonable doubt, as opposed to the preponderance of the clear and convincing standards, as it will create, I think, more litigation. And in addition, it depends upon how you interplay them back and forth. You know, for example, if we're going to go into civil court and we're going to be in a forfeiture proceeding and we have items that were used in the commission of a crime, but once again there was the dismissal for a technical violation or a rule change or whatever, not a rule change, a change in the law possibly that happened in the middle of the prosecution, how do we litigate that? I mean, if someone goes into criminal court and confesses under oath today, typically that can be used in other proceedings. I don't know if that's going to be allowed under the standards that are put forth in these bills.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
I think we're really getting off the fiscal part of this bill and getting way too deeply into the policies.
Thank you, Senator Goodwin. I think the point is any law change here may result in additional litigation.
Yes. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
May I take this back and fill this out, and I'll bring it back
to
the table?
Yes, please. Do so. All right. Any further discussion relating to the specific fiscal impact of Senate File 874? Hearing none. Senator Goodwin?
I'll move the bill.
Moves that Senate File 874 be recommended to pass and be sent to the full Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Senator
Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Senator Coonan, Senate File 932. Senator Coonan is on his way. Senator Sharon, are you ready to proceed with Senate File 347?
Good afternoon, everyone. We're here with Senate File 347, which is the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. And since we're focusing specifically on the fiscal note, because we already have had a hearing on this bill, I'm assuming that everybody has a copy of the fiscal note.
Madam Members, what we have is a preliminary note. Why don't we, so we lay the foundation here properly, ask Mr. Turner to explain the status of the fiscal note on this matter.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members. What we have for Senate File 347 is a preliminary note, fiscal note, which is not a public document. However, for our purposes here, the court section is complete, and that's all we'll be looking at. And then if it will be passed on to full finance, and it will go to Health and Human Services Finance Division. And I can explain the court impact if you'd like me to right now.
Yes.
Okay. The court state that they assume the bill would impact them, impact court staff time, but it's impossible for them to quantify this. The main thing they said is that the bill is effective when the United States ratifies the Hague Convention on the International Recovery of Child Support and other forms of family maintenance. They don't know when that will happen. So the court reports that there's no fiscal impact to them. And so what this committee would do would be recommend the bill to pass to full finance and then be re-referred to the to Health and Human Services Finance Division. And the fiscal note should be complete by then for the Human Services Department.
Senator Sherman.
Thank you. I would like to draw your attention to, if you don't have the fiscal note, on the third page of the fiscal note that I received, there's this language. First of all, there's a wonderful description if people can't remember what this is about, which is to establish a process for collecting child support payments as people move from one geographic area and even to other countries. But the current one-time cost of about $149,000, a state share of about 50 or about half, a third of that, to implement the provisions of the bill once the federal law has been implemented. And I'm hoping my testifier can speak to this, but I've been searching my emails. I thought I'd received an email from Mr. Tennyson that indicated that this had passed at the federal level. And I feel obligated to communicate that. We need to check and make sure if that's the case or not, because then you would be better able, I think, to determine whether or not we will have to accommodate to the $50,000 that's identified here as the state's share of implementation.
And Senator Sherman, I'm sorry, is that $50,000 in the courts or in the human services?
Several different
Maybe
places.
You can show Mr. Turner what
Several
you're referring
different
to.
Places.
He doesn't have that.
It probably. Are you seeing where I'm? I'm looking at page 3 at the very last paragraph. So it looks like it's Human Services.
And Senator Sherman, we're not going to. I can do their work for them today.
There are two steps. That's my guess. But this is not my ballgame.
Right.
Anyway, Senator Latz, I will make certain that I know confirm whether or not this actually has been, if the statute has passed. I know that the Uniform Act has been ratified, but whether or not the statute has passed is what the issue is. I thought I'd gotten some information to indicate that it had. I'll check on that because then it would be clearer.
Okay. But it sounds like from the narrower jurisdiction of the Judiciary Division that there's no court's impact specified. So this has no fiscal impact as far as we're concerned. Judge Davies, is there anything you'd like to add with regard to the absence of fiscal impact?
Not a word.
Very, very wise counsel. All right. Senator Hall, would you like to move Senate File 9? Actually, here's what we're going to do. Members, this one we're going to have to send to full finance so they can send it back down to the HHS division. Senator Hall, make that motion.
Sure.
That Senate File 347 be recommended to pass, be sent to the full Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sherman. Senator Coonan. Senate File 932.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 932 provides for an increased state funding for the counties that provide probation services. The proposal includes 4% increase in funding for both the Community Corrections Act counties and the county probation officers counties. This amounts to $2.3 million each year for the CCA counties and $250,000 each year for the CPO counties. A total cost of the bill for this biennium is $5.1 million. The work these counties do in supervising offenders in the community is a key cog in Minnesota's low-cost correctional system. However, this area of the budget has been neglected. Funding for community supervision has been flat or has even slightly declined over the last decade, and that is in real dollars, not adjusted for inflation. Much like Department of Corrections' proposed budget, a 4% increase, this proposal is designed simply to help these counties keep pace in their current operations. Here to offer some additional information on the need for greater investment in community supervision are Tom Atkins, Community Corrections Officer or Director for Washington County, and Bruce Hagstrom.
Thank you. Mr. Atkins?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. I'm here on behalf of both Washington County but also MACAC, which is the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. We are grateful to Senator Coonan and other authors for authoring this bill and their support in Senate File 932. MACAC represents 32 counties who provide the full range of probation services in those counties. These 32 counties provide about 70% of the probation services for offenders in the state of Minnesota. As Senator Coonan mentioned, funding for community supervision has been flat over the last 10 years. And we understand that this has been a volatile number of years for budget through that time. However, the impact is really we're starting to fall behind our fellow justice partners. And if you need a public safety net, you have to have all of those justice partners funded adequately to perform the job. Over that period of years, the counties have kept probation funding running in Minnesota. And that used to be about a 50-50 split. It's now about a 70-30 split, with the counties picking up the 70% portion of that. Approximately about 85% of the probation clients in Minnesota are supervised by our two delivery systems, and those delivery systems rely on pass-through dollars from the state, and that's where the funding has fallen flat for us. So when I was here last, I suggested that a similar increase, which is about 4% for the Department of Corrections, should be here, and that's what this bill represents for us. It is a lights-on kind of bill. It's not a bill that is going to allow us to do a lot of new things, but it will certainly help in not reducing things that we've already been doing. Community Corrections Act subsidy is one of our primary sources in CCA, and we actually have $2 million less in CCA subsidy at a statewide level now than we did 10 years ago, and that, again, is real dollars as a portion of that. This is becoming a public safety issue for us in terms of how we can deliver these services. In recent years, our staffing complement in Washington County has gone down in our Community Corrections Department by 6%. In Hennepin County, that's gone down 12%. Some of those things we can address through innovations, through targeting our services better, but we're running out of those options. And similar stories like that exist around the state as we look at our other probation departments delivering in these two different delivery systems. This bill really is a bill that can make a difference in the long run for us to start to show a partnership again between the counties and the state in delivering these services. Okay. The bottom line is that community supervision is enormous cost savings to the state of Minnesota. If we did not have community supervision, at roughly $4 a day, we'd be talking about $100 a day institutions to deal with offenders. It does not take a lot of that to change that. I think we're still in the 49th per capita rate for incarceration. And if that prison rate were to change, we would see a significant cost increase here in Minnesota. A modest 10% shift of the probation population into the prison population would result in more than doubling the size of our prison, and the cost would go along with that to do that. Right now, about 25% of adult male felons get a prison sentence. About 92% of them are doing jail time or custody time someplace, and most of that's going to be in the county jails as a result of that. So the fact that we rely heavily on our probation system to make this a cost-effective model makes this even more important. This relatively small investment in our services can help make a difference as we move forward and try and figure out what we're going to do with their coming budget years. We have not seen increases on the state share, and the impact eventually will come back in the form of prison beds. I thank you for your consideration on this bill and appreciate your time, and would be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins. Mr. Hagstrom?
Thank you, Chairman Letts, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Hagstrom. I am here representing the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers. I'm a probation officer myself, have been for 20 years. I want to thank Senator Coonan as well for carrying this bill. As Tom said, this is a huge impact on us. There are 55 counties in the state of Minnesota that receive funding through 244-19 Subdivision 6. It states that the state is to pick up 50% of the cost for probation, and the county is supposed to be a partner at 50%. The last time we were at 50% was 1996. In Chisago County, the shortfall is $108,000. That's $108,000 that the citizens of Chisago County have to pay to maintain our level of services. And even at that, we've lost. We've lost two positions, we've increased fees about as much as we can for additional revenue. But we're not keeping pace. Similarly, Carver County, the shortfall is about $169,000. And Nicollet County, Senator Sheeran's area, their shortfall is also about $107,000. The total difference, to bring us up to a 50% rate, would be about $3 million just for the counties that are organized under 244-19. I appreciate the committee's time, and thank you all and I'm here to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Hagstrom. I'll note that for one reason or another, the governor's budget does not have any additional funds to be appropriated relating to this particular budget. So whatever we might do here it would be above and beyond the governor's recommendation. So I'm going to ask are there any questions, first of all, for either of these two witnesses? Otherwise, I'll have Mr. Turner describe what we've been contemplating here. Senator Dietzick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question, and do you know how, are you going to follow the current formulas to allocate the money, or how is that the additional money going to be allocated?
Mr. Chair, Senator, my understanding is that we would pass this through the primary sources of Community Corrections Act subsidy and the CPO subsidy. That would follow the current existing formulas in those areas.
Thank you.
Mr. Turner, would you please describe some conversations we've had about this?
Mr. Chairman and members, there was no fiscal note requested for this because these are simply pass-through grants. And whatever the legislature decides to pass will go through, as the senator said, the CCA formula, subsidy formula, and be distributed according to that. As it was mentioned, the $4.6 million to CCA and $500,000 to CPO in the bill roughly is roughly equivalent to what the Department of Corrections increase will be this biennium. Just for note, in 2011, the legislature had to cut CCA by $2.6 million and CPO by $326,000, which is one of the reasons that they're in front of us today. I believe that this bill should be laid over for possible inclusion in your budget bill, because all it is a simple line item, a budgetary line item, and that would be my recommendation.
Is there any further questions or discussion? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, you might remember that about a month ago we had a discussion regarding this very issue and kind of the historic perspective that there were promises made by the state of Minnesota to cover these expenses for probation in outstate Minnesota. And somewhere along the path, since the mid-90s, that's kind of fallen off the table. And I don't understand why the counties haven't come and pounded on the table a little bit more, but I think they're, by some of the examples that we've seen, those are examples that they're having a real difficult time covering. And we do have a state that is less prone to put people in prison for low-level offenses, and we've relied heavily on our probation system. And once you do that, that means that those expenses gets transferred to the community corrections across the state, and the counties have to take up the burden. But there was promises made in the mid-90s that we would help them. And that fulfills the mission perspective on incarceration that we took up a long time ago. And it's been rather successful in the state of Minnesota, that not relying on prisons to take care of every single offender is now becoming a model in the country, but that means that the costs get shifted to counties. And at least in rural Minnesota, they don't have necessarily the resources to take our responsibility. And so I'm a co-author on the bill. I think Senator Conan is doing the right thing in introducing this bill. It's an issue that's been long overdue. And I think perhaps, I can't explain why the governor would not have it in his budget, but over the last 2 years when I was a chair, this fell off my table too. So it's an easy line item to fall off when there's constantly other louder voices demanding money. And I think we've kind of forgotten our commitment to the outstate areas, and I think we really should at least keep this in play, and hopefully the governor can see it and maybe see where he can accommodate it as well.
Any further discussion? If there is none, we'll just lay it over. All right, Senate File 932 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Omnibus Bill. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Time.
All right, Senator Cohen is next on the agenda. He's tied up in another matter right now, so we're going to go to Senator Ortman's bill, Senate File 647. Senator Ortman, this bill has already come through our policy committee here, and it will need to go to the HHS Finance Division as well. So if you want to address it specifically relating to the finance implications, and or I can have Mr. Turner explain the fiscal note, whatever your preference is.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much. I was working the room just a little bit, but my phone is turned off, so we should be okay. That I do have an amendment that I'd like to offer, the A4 amendment. When the fiscal note was prepared in the previous version of the bill, I was in negotiations with the Department of Human Services regarding the specific changes to the language that would clarify our intent. And so what the A4 amendment does is it would still require that the Department of Human Services, once a court order has been issued for treatment, the commissioner must take that inmate or that person into custody within 48 hours and provide treatment. What the A4 amendment does, Mr. Chair and members, is it's very specific. It talks about which types of individuals we're talking about and what that treatment would be.
Senator Orban, we need to have the amendment distributed.
I'm sorry. I think
we can look at it. Go ahead and describe it. I'm just letting you know we don't have it in front of us.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. So what it does is it specifies that when folks have been ordered to treatment for competency, to restore competency, for being mentally ill and dangerous and being committed to the care and custody of the Department of Human Services or evaluated for those purposes, that the commissioner then must take those folks into custody within 48 hours. The conversation was about, I think we've made some very important improvements in being very specific about the individuals that we're talking about, but this amendment has some other very important improvements that I am very supportive of, and I'm really grateful to DHS for helping me work through them. Number one, it would allow our Commissioner of the Department of Human Services to prioritize these individuals, and I think as patients they should be prioritized. They're coming out of our courts, and there is a court order for treatment. Number two, on line 1.21, the language has been changed to allow a little bit more flexibility to the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services so that they can grant a service instead of a placement in a facility. And I think referencing to a service would allow that least restrictive alternative, if it's medically appropriate, to be used. And that is what our law requires. It is that we don't incarcerate people, we don't put them in facilities beyond what is the least restrictive need for that particular individual. So I think that's a very important change. And then there was a little bit of conversation about whether the 48 hours should include or exclude weekends and holidays. And I'm grateful that the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services has agreed that 48 hours will mean 48 hours. And there was an example recently in the Hennepin County Jail of someone that had been ordered for treatment, no criminal charges pending. And those are the types of cases that we're talking about here. They should not be held even for the possibility of 4 or 5 days when there aren't even criminal charges pending because they've been on a mental health apprehension. So with those amendments, I believe that the sheriffs, they're here, and DHS and the National Alliance of Mentally Ill are supportive of this amendment, and I believe that the fiscal cost has been eliminated. And so, members, I would move the A4 amendment.
Thank you. Let me just get a confirmation. Mr. Turner, have you had an opportunity to evaluate whether or not the fiscal cost has been eliminated with this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, members, I believe it has, but I would like to have the Department of Human Services on the record as saying
they're
it
here.
Does.
Okay. Is there someone here from DHS?
Right.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Joanne Jones. I'm the legislative liaison for Chemical Mental Health Services and State Operated Services for the Department of Human Services. You got all that?
Got it.
Good afternoon. I'm here today briefly just to answer your questions regarding this and to echo Senator Ortman's comments about the amendment.
So is it the position of the Department of Human Services that with this amendment there'll be no fiscal cost?
Going forward with the new amended language, yes, that is our position.
All right. Are there any questions for Ms. Jones? Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask if, you know, when I read this, I'm not sure if it takes care of people who are not under current care in any way or haven't been under current care. So if somebody goes to jail and they haven't been being seen for a mental illness, but they're identified as having a mental illness while they're in jail, what happens to them?
Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, this bill would not affect those folks. This would affect only those that have a court order. So the current law would continue. But I would say, and I'm certain that DHS can speak to this, there is work to be done for all of us to go back and say, how can we make sure that people who need treatment, whether they're in jail or not, get adequate care and treatment? And you have my commitment. I'll be working over the interim to find additional ways to do that. And I've heard from a Deputy Commissioner Barry her commitment as well to do exactly that.
Thank you.
Senator Dziedzic, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a technical question. In the delete all, so in the original one, there's an effective date. So do you need an effective date on this? Don't see one in the delete all amendment, so I'm just asking.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dziedzic, I think it's a great question. I don't know, but perhaps counsel can advise.
Mr. Chair and members, the default effective date is going to be August 1. So if that's the intent, then right.
Any further questions or comments? Senator Ortman has moved the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion on Senate File 647?
Mr. Chair, I would ask that Senate File 647 as amended be moved to the Finance Committee just so we can verify that there are no costs going forward. I would hope that this bill would go forward to the Senate floor if there are no costs and we could just move it.
Yeah, Senator Ortman, it has to go there anyway since we don't have the power as a division to send anything directly to the floor. So Senator Ortman moves that Senate File 647 be recommended to pass and be referred to the full Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevailed.
Members, thank you very much.
Senator Goodwin, I'm going to ask you to come over and take the chair. Senator Cohen's not here yet, is he?
Number seven on the agenda is Senate File 7, so that should be lucky.
Madam Chair, members, this is Senate File number 7. And, I believe we have, is there an amendment in the packets for this? No amendments on this one? So I would ask at this point, we did hear this in the policy committee relating to guardians and conservators. So I'd ask Mr. Turner to describe the fiscal aspect of the bill.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, members, the Senate File 7 fiscal note is incomplete. However, the court section, which is what we're concerned with, is in. It also has to go to DHS, and this morning I was told that it has to go to state government finance as well because there's a possible cost to commerce. As far as the court portion is concerned, the court states that it can absorb most of the costs in the bill, including the additional staff time needed to review it, the background checks for conservators and guardians. It will absorb. There'll be about 180 more cases per year, it's estimated, and the court says it can absorb the small judge unit that would require, and it could absorb the required changes to court documents. The one thing the court noted that it at least did not want to absorb was the additional audit responsibility for the new 180 cases. They said that it would require one-seventh of an auditor FTE. An auditor costs $87,000 a year, so they multiplied $87,000 by 0.7 and came up with a $61,000 request. That wouldn't give us an auditor. So my recommendation is either fund the bill at $87,000 or pass the bill with the expectation that the court's conservator account auditing program would absorb the extra workload. Either way, the bill needs to go to finance and then to Health and Human Services and then state government.
Mr. Turner, I understand that if the courts were asked to absorb that extra auditing aspect of it, that in effect they wouldn't hire any additional staff. There might be a little lengthier process to be able to process the additional caseload. Is that what you've been informed?
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, that's correct.
That's what I would ask the committee to do this time. I have Mr. Voigt from the Attorney General's office here with me to answer any questions. This is just a purely budget question at this point.
Members, do you have any questions? Seeing none, is there anybody, Senator Latz, that you want to testify?
No, I just ask. I move that Senate File number 7 be recommended to pass and be sent to the full Finance Committee.
Okay. Senator Latz moves the bill to the full Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Motion carries.
Thank you.
Senator Latz has another bill on the agenda. It's Senate File 235. Senator Latz.
Thank you. Members, Senate File 235 is the bill relating to firearm lawful possession and crime of violence modifications that had some fiscal aspect to the bill. You will recall in previous hearings that when we had testimony and consideration of policy relating to reducing gun violence, that the provisions are divided into two separate bills, one that was pure policy that was sent to the Senate floor, the other that had some policy that had fiscal implications, and that's what is before us today, is just the fiscal implication portion of the bill.
Senator Latz, I understand you have a technical amendment.
I do. Senator Goodwin, since the Policy Committee addressed this matter, the BCA has taken a look at the bill and had some suggestions for accomplishing the same policy ends, but making it work much better and, in fact, reducing the cost of doing so. So I would ask the committee to adopt the A7 amendment, and I have someone from the BCA here to explain or answer any questions that you may have.
Do we have the amendment? We do. Okay, that would be the A7 amendment. Could you please state your name for the record?
Certainly, Madam Chair. I'm Katie Engler with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I don't know what the committee's preference is, but since you're focusing on fiscal items today, most of the changes that you see that change the amount of time from 72 hours to 3 business days has an impact on the Bureau because it means we don't have to hire people to work over weekends and holidays in order to meet the 72 hours and reduces most of our fiscal note that we had to submit. Couple of other comments about the changes in the bill. Section 2 is a provision that would have required the Department of Human Services to submit information to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. I did check with those federal folks, and because Human Services is not the state authority that civilly commits people, they are not an accepted source of the data. So that's why we recommended to Senator Latz that that section come out.
Ms. Engler, if I may ask, I understand that data will be submitted by different sources. Oh, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, that's correct. In, excuse me, I need to find it. Section 13 of the bill, it, with the amendments, directs that courts electronically enter information into that National Instant Criminal Background System for civil commitments for the period January 1, 2008 to September 28, 2010. And the strange end date is because on September 29, 2010, courts began submitting information on civil commitments under the language that you see in Section 3 of the bill, which tells courts to send civil commitment information to NICS. The other thing I should draw your attention to is...
Madam Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt. Would it be
Senator
appropriate
Ortman?
To ask a question about that particular provision now or when you're done?
That's fine, Senator Ortman. Go ahead.
About the reach-back, because this was language that I included in my original bill. I'm wondering if you're eliminating the reach-back for both the mental illness data and also criminal records data in your amendment.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, we did not suggest a change for the criminal history data.
Madam Chair, so will there still be a reach back for all that data that has not yet been updated?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, yes, if you look in line 8.19 of the first engrossment, this is about the felonies to be entered for the years 2008 to 2012 that have not already been entered into a searchable database.
Right. And then, Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
The original reach back for the mental illness data, and this was court-ordered mental illness data, was going back to 1994. Can you explain what who does have that information and how it's going to get updated?
Ms. Engler.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, the 1994 date is in Section 2, which was the Direction to Human Services, which, as I explained, is not an acceptable source to NICS for those data. If you wish those data to go, then the acceptable source would be courts.
Well, Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I think that's a key provision and a very important gap in the NICS index that needs to be addressed, which is why I drafted it in the first place. Whether the courts are acceptable or whether DHS through the BCA is acceptable, I don't know. Is it possible for that DHS information to pass through the BCA and be updated into the NICS index?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, no. Human Services is not an acceptable source of data to NICS.
Madam Senator Chair, Ortman. Then should DHS be sending the information to the courts to make sure that it's updated?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman,
Senator.
The data at Human Services originally comes from courts. Courts civilly commits people both to Human Services and to private providers for treatment. And so the data at Human Services is a subset of the data held by courts for civil commitments.
Senator Ortman.
Sorry for the follow-up, Madam Chair, but then does that mean we should be asking the courts to reach back to 1994 to look for civil commitment data and records that are show adjudication and include that in the NICS index?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, that's a policy decision for you to make.
Well, Madam Chair, one of the greatest gaps in our system. And I worry, Senator Letts, taking this out may eliminate the cost, but I think people are counting on that NICS index as the source of information when a permit is being evaluated, a permit application.
Senator and Gooden, so I would support having the courts reach back to 1994.
Thank
Senator
you. And
Ortman.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I think we should have an amendment to do that, Senator Letts. I think it's a really important aspect of this bill. And I think it may have a cost. I'm not sure about how the mandate works for the courts, though. And so I don't know about that. I don't know if there are questions of that, and maybe counsel can provide some guidance on that.
Senator Ortman, do you have a recommended amendment, or should we talk to counsel here, find out if they have something to fix that now?
Madam Chair, I haven't prepared anything because I hadn't seen the A7 amendment. Okay. So my apologies.
Mr. Backus or Mr. Turner? Anybody got a phone near the mic?
I don't think so.
Mr. Chair, and I'll maybe look for some help from maybe Ms. Engler, but I believe would it not be then changing the A7 amendment line 2.8 to delete January 1, 2008 and insert 1994. I think that's the concept.
Madam Chair, Mr. Backus, I would agree with you. That's what I'm hearing the concept is.
So,
could you repeat that? I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
I believe then if it, to effectuate what you're intending to accomplish, I think if you look at the A7 amendment line 2.8, if you were to delete 2008, the second 2008, and insert 1994, then you would be doing that much of a look back. I think that's what you would want.
Madam Chair.
I would consider that to be a friendly amendment.
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, members, I'd like to point out that Section 13 already has a cost associated with it on a reach back to 2008, and to go back to 1994, I would imagine that cost would rise. Perhaps the courts could address this.
Is there
in the room.
Someone from the courts that would like to address that?
While they're approaching,
Senator Letts.
I believe there was a time frame included in the original bill for the reach back to be accomplished as well. And I think if necessary for fiscal reasons, maybe we might have to stretch out the deadline for accomplishing the reach back with the data. I hope Senator Ortman would consider that to see what the courts have to say about the fiscal impact of the reach-back period.
Senator Ortman.
Well, Madam Chair, I understand. I've just learned that there was an amendment in the House that may be of interest for that. But the original reason for putting in the 1994 reach back date is that those there was a requirement that DHS submit that information, and it just had not been done, probably because they weren't an accepted source. We're learning 20 years later. So I would offer the amendment that Council Baucus has suggested. I think that's a good change, and then we can work on whether or not the dates for getting those updates have an impact, and also on whether or not that adds to the fiscal cost, which maybe could be considered later. But I think it's a very important change to this bill before it goes forward.
Okay. Senator Ortman accepts that, or Senator Latz accepts that as a friendly amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Senator Governor, I'd ask if we could hear from the court.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, of course. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Marshall, and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. As Chris Turner has pointed out, going back to 2008 will have a fiscal impact on us. That's over 11,000 files that someone has to review. And we calculate even if you only take a few minutes per file, that's a lot to do, and it would take probably one person 1 year to be able to go back and look at all those cases. Going back to 1994, we're in the process of trying to compile that cost. The complicating factor there is that we're going to have to go back to historical societies and places like that because we do not have electronic records. And they will be paper files that we're going to have to be reviewing. So there will be a cost for that.
Ms. Marshall, do you have any estimate?
No, we just now, actually this afternoon, someone is trying to figure that out.
All right. Thank you. All right.
Senator Goodwin?
Yes.
I think
Senator
what I would ask, it was our intent to carry the funding for this provision in the omnibus judiciary funding bill. So I would ask that we make the change to the 1994 today and send this bill forward. It's got to go to full finance anyway, and we'll take up the judiciary omnibus funding bill next Tuesday, and it'll be my intent to address the funding component of it in that bill.
All right. So the Ortman amendment to change line 2.8, January 1st, 2008 date to January 1st, 1994 date to the A7 amendment. That's amendment to the A7 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Now we're back to the amendment.
Madam Chair, I have nothing further for you unless someone has a question.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. Anybody have questions before she leaves? Okay, thank you very much. We're back to the book. Well, the A7 amendment. Now we need to vote on that. All in favor, say aye. Whoop. Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, is there a change? And this is for the BCA. Is there a change on the or for the courts? Either is there a change to as soon as is practicable again for the timeline on the reporting on mental health adjudications and criminal convictions?
Where are you referring to, Senator Ortman?
I'm trying to find it. 8.11.
8.11? That must be on the bill rather than the amendment.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, the amendment does not affect line 8.11.
Madam Chair.
With
respect to Senator Latz, I believe that this was a change that was made from the original bill back to as soon as is practicable. But the original bill purposely changed that notice of the disposition of the charge to within 24 hours. And the reason we did that is because, well, the reason it was included in the bill with the 24 hours instead of as soon as is practicable, there may be courts that don't have a clerk today, don't have, there are courts that it may never be practicable in the state of Minnesota, but with a specific time frame, they should be able to provide that information. And felony conviction records are now currently being reported within 24 hours, and I think we want to just stick to the 24 hours. And so I would hope that Senator Latz would agree.
Senator Letts, Ms. Marshall is back at the table. Did
you? Yes, Ms. Marshall, too.
Okay. Excellent.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I would respectfully disagree that all felony convictions are getting recorded within 24 hours. As you said, we have some small clerk of court's offices out there. We have some in the state that have 1.5 employees. So it is not always possible to get this stuff done in 24 hours, especially if it's a Friday. I'm really sorry, but we can't do that at this point in time.
Senator Ortman.
Well, with all due respect to the courts, the mandate under law currently on those felony convictions is 24 hours. Isn't that correct?
Madam Ms. Chair, Marshall. Senator Ortman, I don't know that.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator maybe Ortman. Senator or the Senator Counselor can update us on that information.
Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I don't know the answer. Where are you referring to that?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I don't have the reference today.
Senator Ortman, I think what she's saying is it's not in the bill, it's in current law.
I believe it's in current law that requirement is 24 hours. And Madam Chair, there's a really good reason for that, because getting the felony convictions and the mental health adjudication records into our system within 24 hours, remember we have a very short window of opportunity under Minnesota law for the evaluation of a permit application. And we want to make sure this information gets in within a timely basis. It's very important, and it's not just our Minnesota law enforcement that's using this system, it's also being used nationwide. And so when I originally drafted the bill, I purposely changed the language from as soon as practicable to within 24 hours.
Senator Goodwin, Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
May I offer a suggestion that instead of as soon as practicable, we put within 3 business days? That would still fall within the 7 days that is required for responding to a permit application. It takes away the issue of keeping staff working over the weekend, and Ms. Marshall's indicated that can be accomplished by the courts.
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, I think
Ortman.
That's an improvement. There's at least a time certain here, and I think that's really important. As soon as practicable, you can see sometimes it's never practicable, unfortunately. So
okay,
I think that's a good change, Senator Latz.
Senator Ortman. That is not in the amendment that I can see.
It's not. So
it's in the bill. So
if
we should probably
vote on
the amendment.
If you want to adopt the A7 and
let's
then
adopt the
A7 that.
Amendment first.
Sure.
Senator Limmer.
Question on the A7. Senator Latz, could you look at page 2, lines 3 through 5?
There's of the bill or the amendment?
On the amendment. There's a reference to a U.S. Code Title 18. I was wondering if you could explain how that fits into the bill.
Senator?
Ask Ms. Engler to respond to that, please.
Ms. Engler.
Madam Chair, Katie Engler again from the BCA. Senator Limmer, the reference is to the codification of the Brady Act in federal law, and the specific references are for, unfortunately, the federal language is quite arcane. Talks about people who are mentally defective. So it's the equivalent of what we now consider civil commitment.
Madam Chair, is the Senator reference
Limmer.
Here limited just to those with a mental illness or commitment?
Ms. Anker?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I'm looking at the language. The reference to D4 has been adjudicated as a mental defective or has been committed to any mental institution, and G4 is it's an unlawful for any person. 4 is who has been adjudicated as a mental defective or who has been committed to a mental institution. So these are the prohibitors that are listed in federal law.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer.
Ms. Engler, when we talk of a commitment to a mental institution, that requires a court review and an order, does it not?
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that is correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
Senator Ortman.
To clarify, if someone is coming from an involuntary civil commitment, that's coming from a court order, but there are voluntary commitments, and they are not necessarily included here.
Okay, any more questions? Otherwise, we're voting on the A7 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Now we were on the bill. Senate File 235.
Madam Chair.
Amended.
Okay, if I could, I'd like to offer that amendment to line 8.11 and delete as soon as practicable and insert within 3 business days.
Any comments, Senator Latz?
Consider that a friendly amendment.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Okay, the bill is amended and amended. Is there, Senator Latz, did you have anybody to testify on the bill? You want to go to a fiscal note on it, or is there some?
Yes, if we could address the fiscal note.
Okay, Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair and members, once again, we have an incomplete fiscal note, but the parts that we are that concern us, I will go over. There's 3 agencies that are affected: DOC, DPS, and the courts. For the Department of Corrections, Section 10 adds felony fifth-degree assault, felony domestic assault, and domestic assault by strangulation to the definition of crime of violence for the purposes of possessing a firearm. Sentencing Guidelines estimates that this will result in 2 commitments to the commissioner in 2014, 6 in 2016, and 12 in 2017 and subsequent years. That means there isn't much of a fiscal impact in this biennium. It's $24,000, which is minimal. It'd be my recommendation that we not make a separate appropriation for this biennium, but that we should carry the tails in the budget bill. MMB will, and so it would be proper that we did as well. The cost of DPS apparently have been addressed in the amendment. It had record keeping and reporting provisions that totaled $93,000. The cost of the court,
now they are equal zero.
Actually, I believe there's $10,000 in programming costs that are attached to Section 10 of the bill on the expansion of the definition of violence, and they are not connected to the $83,000. Is that correct?
Ms. Engler?
Madam Chair, again, for the record, Katie Engler with the Bureau. Mr. Turner is correct. The $10,000 in programming costs is related to the language for crime of violence, the definitional change in Section 10. The $83,000 in employee costs is what was eliminated in the A7 by changing 72 hours to 3 business days.
Mr. Turner?
Madam Chair, members. Yes, that's what I've got here, is that $10,000 in programming costs remain. The committee could either fund them or request that the department absorb the cost. Either way, if they fund them, it will be funded in the Judiciary Finance Bill. Then moving on to the courts, Section 12 and 13 have fiscal implications for the courts. Section 12 requires the court to report a crime of violence, pretrial diversion, and certain gross misdemeanors to the BCA for submission to NICS. The gross misdemeanors include a violation of an order for protection, fifth-degree assault, domestic assault, stalking, the persons ineligible to possess definition, and firearms surrendered as a condition of release. The courts estimate that this data integration project is quite extensive, and they say that they would have a one-time cost in fiscal year 14 of $2,500. Section 13 requires a one-time data cleanup effort to report all civil commitment orders issued from January 2008 to September 2010. That was the provision that we just amended. It now reads from 1994 to 2010, and I'll be requesting a new fiscal note on the second engrossment, and we will get those costs before we go to full finance.
Section 13. Mr. Turner, you say $2,500 on the data integration or $250,000?
Correct.
$2,500?
No, I'm sorry, $250,000. Did I say $2,500?
I would welcome that, but yeah. I'm afraid you said that, yeah.
I'm sorry, excuse me. Yes, $250,000.
excuse me, Senator.
Senator Sheeran, are you on Section 13 that would have that cost? In this summary here, the time frame is 2008 to 2012. You're saying 2010. To enter data on civil commitments and felony commitments, 2008 to 2012?
No. Madam Chair.
Mr. Turner.
Senator Sheeran. Section 13 wants the court to report civil commitments from that have been issued between January 2008 and September 2010 to the National, to NICS, National Integrated Criminal Service, or whatever it is, National Investigative Crime System. We amended the bill to make the reach back to 1994, and that was, and that is going to have probably a substantial cost, and that's what the new fiscal note, what the new fiscal note will address.
And thank you. I'm just trying to align what you're saying. I can go back to the bill here, but with this bill summary, it uses different dates. So. About Section 13.
Oh, no. Madam Chair, Senator Sheeran.
Mr. Turner.
It says September 1st, 2013 is the deadline for the courts to accomplish this task. The deadline for them to... Oh, I see you have 2012 here. Yeah, that's just it's a typo in the summary, I guess.
Mr. Turner?
Senator Latz.
Chair, Mr. Turner, we had talked about extending a deadline to ease the crunch on the courts. Is this the provision that we talked about?
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, yes, it is. The court said that they could accomplish the original language, 2008 to 2010, in
2012 and the bill too.
1 to 2 years. Now that it's going back to 2000. Or until to 1994, I don't, you know, I couldn't guess how long that would take if it wasn't funded.
Okay. So in that regard, Madam Chair, what I'd recommend is that we wait until we get the fiscal note back from the courts with to reflect the amendment, and we'll ask them to include in that fiscal note a time frame, and then we can address that question in full finance.
So, Senator Latz, would you want to still pass this on to finance?
Yes.
And, okay. All right.
Madam Chair.
We have the bill as amended.
Madam Chair.
Senator,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I learned that there's another area that had a time frame on it that was taken out for prompt reporting, and it's Section 11, Senator Latz. It's the prompt reporting for the current. Now, it's the current requirement that prompt reporting of disqualifying mental health data, those same prohibitors, needs to have that same within 3 business days. And perhaps counsel can tell me where that should go.
Madam Chair,
oh, Senator Latz,
I would have to check the original bill, which I don't have here, but I don't believe that those provisions were changed in this. I believe the provisions that appear here that we're referring to were put in verbatim from your bill. Now, again, I would have to double-check that, but well, that was my recollection.
I'm sure I can clarify this,
Senator Latz,
for you. The Section 11 was replaced in the A7 amendment.
Correct.
Starting on line 1.18.
Give members one a little bit here to look at that.
Madam Chair, if I might help. Katie Engler again from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. If you look in the engrossment, Section 11, lines 7.11 to 7.16 are the same language that's or same requirements that found in Section 3 of the bill. It's reporting of civil commitment data to NICS. And so with the A7 amendment, what was preserved was the notification requirement in the original bill or in the engrossment on line 7.17 and 7.18 telling the courts to give people notification, and the language appears in the A7 in lines 2.3 through 2.5.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I'm trying to understand what happened, Senator Letts or counsel or whoever, what happened to the requirement that the going forward, the disqualifying mental health data shall be entered electronically and the time frame. Is there now a time frame for that within the current construct of the bill as amended? That's my question.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, yes. If you look on the first engrossment, Section 3, current law requires the civil commitment information to move from courts to NICS, and in line 2.22, the 24-hour requirement sits there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Letts.
It looks like current statute says as soon as practicable, and the proposed amended language is within 24 hours, and I think it would make more sense to line that up with the other language we've already amended to make it within 3 business days.
I agree. Madam Chair,
okay.
I agree.
Can we have somebody state amendment line?
I'll move to amend page 2, line 22, by deleting within 24, the new language, and replacing it with within 3 business days.
Does everybody have that? Within 3 business days. Okay, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Now it's the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Letts.
I have nothing further to present.
Okay.
So
and any further questions? If not, Senate File 235 as amended is recommended to pass and move to full Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Senator Letts is going to resume the chair now. He has some announcements to make. Thank you.
Senator Constance. Senator Cohen, Senate File 1241.
Mr. Chairman and members, we heard this bill a couple weeks ago. I don't know if is Ms. Mitchell still here. This is the bill dealing with presumptive sentences for sex offenders with the accidental repeal. So members have heard the policy discussion relative to this bill. We do have the fiscal note that indicates that for this biennium, the fiscal request is for $56,000. For the 16-17 biennium, it's $181,000. So it's of minimal expense to correct this mistake. Mr. Chairman, again, we had discussion about this bill 2 weeks ago. Would you like me to go through the bill in detail?
No, I would just ask Mr. Turner to address the fiscal question.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen's correct. Sentencing guidelines estimates 2 to 3 prison commits a year, $56,000 in estimated cost first biennium, $181,000 in subsequent. This is, in some respects, like your gun bill. $56,000 is a marginal cost. We would definitely, if you decide not to fund the first biennium, we would definitely track the tails of $181,000 in 2016, 17, and subsequent bienniums. I would like to point out, though, that apparently this bill is rectifying something that was deleted in 2006, and we never took a savings when it was deleted. And so should we carry a cost when it's re-added?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the
Senator Cohen.
The money, if there had been a savings from the previous biennium, it would have gone to the bottom line. And so it's been taken, it will be taken into account with the all funds balance. So I know, Mr. Chairman, chairs always look for more money to spend, but it's probably been accounted for.
Senator Cohen, I'm not looking for any money to spend here. I'm just looking to reduce the amount of money that we need to account for here. You're the one with experience in the budgeting process here, but I don't know if Department of Corrections ever recognized in their budget requests a reduction in their costs relating to the inadvertent deleting of this provision statute.
Mr. Chairman, I can't speak for what happened with the Department of Corrections, but again, if there are surplus monies within the account of an agency, they should be accounted for, and they would fall to the bottom line, and then, again, would be reflected in the all funds balance. I can't speak for the particular appropriation from whenever it was 8 years ago or so, but we've gone through several bienniums, so I would expect somewhere that money was either expended within the agency or, again, might have been reflected in the all funds balance. In any account, I'd be very, very surprised if the amount has not already been taken into account in some way.
Well, members, I think what I'm going to recommend with this bill is that we pass on to full financing. We'll address it in the omnibus judiciary bill. Is that what we had talked about, Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, members, that's correct. I'd just like to say for the record, bills like this are very difficult because there's just marginal cost to a huge system. We have 9,600 inmates, and we're talking about three or four inmates. And on any given day, the department is up or down, 60, 70 inmates above projection or below projection. So these bills are very difficult. We have to track them because that's the way we work things, but it's hard to make some of these calls. I'd like to note that the governor's request for the institutions division of the Department of Corrections is an increase in their base of $32 million over the next biennium. And so sometimes, an estimated cost of $56,000 seems like it should just, we can just drop it. But we really, to be honest to ourselves, we really should track what these bills cost. In past years, when we had a number of sentencing increases, we'd have one line item for funding the criminal provisions that have passed within the omnibus crime bill. We haven't been passing many sentencing increases lately, so we haven't had that line in many years.
Mr. Chairman,
how would you like to proceed?
Mr. Chairman is correct. We need to count the money. Mr. Tracy just indicated to me that apparently there were conversations with the Department of Corrections. They indicated this money had been absorbed in their budget. So if we assume that that's correct, then we need to have this money accounted for. I think it's difficult, whether it be this issue or any other issue throughout this building, to go to agencies and say, you take care of that within your budget. That starts to mount up, and we do that a little bit too often around here, where we assume with some of these insignificant issues we can have agencies simply absorb that within their budget, and that's a lot easier said than done. Plus, it's in terms of the budget process, it's a very bad way to handle accounting in terms of the state budget.
It'll be my intent to carry the funding for this bill in the omnibus judicial finance bill.
Right.
Are there any further discussion or questions on the Senate file? They're not hearing any. Then Senator Cohen moves that Senate file 1241 be recommended to pass and be referred to the full finance committee. Referred to the full finance committee. All those in favor?
Aye.
Something further, Senator Cohen?
Mr. Chairman, before we vote on it, if your intent was to absorb this within your finance bill, do you want it sent to the full finance committee or kept within this committee as the division?
I'm trying to keep as much policy language as I can out of the full finance bill.
Okay,
so
fine.
While I will carry the budget line, I'd rather.
Okay, I see what you mean. Fine. Language. Okay, then I would move. Then I'd move that Senate File 1241 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Members,
Chairman. Members.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. So that concludes the items on the agenda for today. We will be meeting Tuesday at noon here, at which time we will take up two, what I anticipate, short bills, and then we will go over the Judiciary Omnibus Finance Bill, which will be a delete all to Senate File 671. We're doing our best to match up the vehicles with the House, since they have two committees that address some of the issues this committee addresses. We will post the spreadsheet and the bill the afternoon of Monday, April 8th. And it's our intention to vote on the budget bill April 9th and move it to the full Finance Committee, where I expect it'll be heard that Friday, I think, is the anticipation, the 12th of April. So there being no further business to come before the committee, we are adjourned, or the division, we are adjourned.